It's 7:30. We present Watto Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Starring Michael Horden as Jeeves and Richard Briers as Bertie Wooster. Mating Season, Episode 2, The Great Web.
Esmond Haddock may have been squire of Devereux Hall, and he may have looked like an above-average Greek god, all broad shoulders and muscles like writhing snakes, but there was no getting away from the fact that he crawled to his aunt's. And I must confess that when Dame Daphne Winkworth suddenly appeared in the dining room on my first night at Devereux and found self on a chair waving a decanter of port, and this Haddock standing on the table using a banana as a hunting crop, I was shocked by his deportment. It was the deportment of a craven and a worm. He came tumbling down from the table like an apologetic sack of coals, and slunk from the room, his whole demeanor so crushed and cringing that I could hardly bear to look at him. What we'd been doing, of course, was rehearsing Esmond's Hello, 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 A Hunting We Will Go song for the forthcoming village concert. But there's no point expecting an ex-headmistress like Dame Daphne Winkworth to understand a thing like that. The old geezer clearly considered that we were fried to the tonsils, and so when she suggested in a voice that was as cold and hard as a picnic egg that I go straight to bed, I accepted the proposal with alacrity, if only to terminate a painful scene. In addition, of course, I was most anxious to get in touch with Jeeves, who long ere this, I felt, must have arrived by train with a heavy luggage. Accordingly, when Silversmith, the butler, showed me to my well-appointed chamber, I asked for my man to be sent along in a stanter. A few minutes later, the door opened, and there entered a familiar form. But it wasn't the familiar form of Jeeves. It was a familiar form of Claude Catamole Pertwright.
Catmeat!
Meadows.
What do you mean, Meadows?
That is my name while I remain in your employment. I'm your man.
My man?
Your valet, your attendant, your gentleman's personal gentleman. It's quite simple. Jeeves couldn't come.
What?
No.
You mean Jeeves isn't going to be at my side?
That's right. So I'm taking his place. What are you doing?
Turning my face to the wall.
Why?
Well, wouldn't you turn your face to the wall if you were in my position? Here I am, trapped in this abode of thugs and ghouls, having to pretend to be Gussie Fink-Nottle because the real Augustus has been jugged for wading in the Trafalgar Square fountain at your instigation, may I remind you, Catmeat. And now you tell me I'm going to be without Jeeves' comfort and advice. Oh, hell! Blast! Damn! Why couldn't Jeeves come? Is he ill?
No, Jeeves isn't ill. What stopped him coming was the fact that his Uncle Charlie is the butler here.
Why the devil should that stop him?
My good Bertie, use your intelligence, if any. Everyone here thinks you are Gussie Fink-Nottle. Uncle Charlie, on the other hand, knows that Jeeves is the keeper of Bertram Wooster. No doubt Jeeves writes him weekly letters saying how happy he is with you and how nothing would ever induce him to switch elsewhere. So what do you think would happen if he suddenly showed up here claiming to be a member of a Fink-Nottle entourage? I'll tell you what would happen. Uncle Charlie's suspicions would be aroused, and in next to no time, he would be tearing off your whiskers and denouncing you. Obviously, Jeeves couldn't come.
Well, there's something in that, I suppose, but why didn't he tell me, dash it?
It only occurred to him after you'd left.
Well, couldn't he have squared Silversmith?
No. Apparently, he's one of those fellows who can't be squared, a man of very rigid principles.
Well, every man has his price.
Not Jeeves's Uncle Charlie. My gosh, Bertie, what a lad. He received me when I arrived, all 16 stone of him, and my bones turned to water. That large, bald head, those pale, protruding gooseberry eyes. He's the living image of some of those old pros who used to give me such a hell of a time when I first went on the stage. If it hadn't been for Queenie leading me from the presence and buoying me up with a quick cooking sherry, I might have swooned in my tracks.
Who's Queenie?
Haven't you met her? The parlourmaid, delightful girl. Engaged to the village policeman, a fellow named Dobbs. Have you ever tasted cooking sherry, Bertie? Odd stuff.
It is no time for desultory chit-chat about cooking sherry, Catsweet. Let us return to the nub. What are you doing here? I can understand Jeeves's reason for backing out, but I can't see why you had to come.
You can't see why I had to come? To be with Gertrude Winkworth, of course. I want her to elope with me, so it's vital I should be on the spot, pleading with her, reasoning with her, trying to break down her sales resistance. You've nothing against my being here, have you?
Well,
so, you have some far-fetched objection to the scheme, have you? You don't want me to win the girl I love.
Of course I want you to win the ballet girl you love.
Well, I can't do it by mail.
All right, all right. Have you seen her?
Gertrude? Yes, just before I came up here. I was in the hall and she suddenly appeared from the drawing room.
I suppose she was surprised to see you dressed like that.
Surprised is right. She swayed and tottered. Queenie said, oh, miss, are you ill, and rushed off to get Sal Volatile.
Oh, Queenie was there?
Yes, Queenie was there with her hair in a braid. She had just been telling me how worried she was about the spiritual outlook of her betrothed. He's an atheist, you see, and every time she tries to make him see the light, he just twirls his moustache and quotes Colonel Robert G. Ingersoll at her. This upsets the poor girl.
She's very pretty.
Oh, extraordinarily pretty. I don't remember ever having seen a prettier parlour maid.
Gertrude, not Queenie.
Oh, Gertrude. Well, dash it, you don't need to tell me that. She's a top. She begins where Helen of Troy left off,
in sharp contradistinction to her mother, I may say.
Which is she? I've seen about 300 aunts so far, all of early Victorian vintage, but I've no idea which is which.
Look out for the rugged, light heavyweight with a touch of Wallace Beery in her makeup. That's Dame Daphne Winkworth.
Oh, her. Good Lord.
Now, Bertie, one other thing of the utmost importance. You remember I told you that snake in the grass, Esmond Haddock, was giving Gertrude the rush of a lifetime? Well, it's coming to a head.
Oh, yes?
Don't say, oh, yes, in that horribly casual way. I hope you haven't weakened. You are still in your splendid, resolute frame of mind of yesterday. I can rely on you to foil and baffle this foul blot.
I like Esmond Haddock.
Then you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
It's all right, Catsmith. You can simmer down. Gertrude Winkworth means nothing to Esmond Haddock. He's not really pursuing her with his addresses.
He's not?
No. All that stuff is just to make Corky jealous.
What?
I had it from his own lips. We got matey over the port. Corky is still the lodestar of his life. You may be her brother, but you had your facts all twisted. Esmond didn't give Corky the brush off. She gave him the brush off because of his aunt fixation. And all this rushing Gertrude is just a ruse to bring her round, so you can cease to regard him as a menace.
Is this official?
Absolutely.
You say Corky is still the lodestar of his life? That's what he told me.
Whoopee! My gosh, Bertie, you've taken a weight off my mind.
I thought you'd be pleased.
You bet I'm pleased.
Well, good night.
You're off.
Yes, I shall leave you now, much as I enjoy your company, because I have man's work to do elsewhere. When I was chatting with Queenie, she happened to mention that she knows where Uncle Charlie keeps the key to the cellar. So long. I shall hope to see more of you later.
But, Casimir, you're not going to leave me here on my own.
Why not?
Well, dash it, here I am serving an indeterminate sentence in this valley place with no one to comfort me.
Bertie?
Yes?
Good night.
But, Casimir.
Good night.
What? Dash the fellow.
Just before I at last got to sleep that night, I thought I heard the front doorbell ring and a murmur of offstage voices which seemed to indicate that another guest had blown in after closing time. And so when the silversmith brought me my tea ration the next a.m., I inquired who this might be. He replied that it was a Mr. Worcester. And before I could ask him what the devil he was talking about, he disappeared, leaving not a rack behind. I could make nothing of it. Mr. Worcester, the man had said. And the only explanation which seemed to offer itself was that I'd recently been in the presence of a butler who'd been having a couple. And yet it's a very frivolous butler who gets a load on before 9 in the morning. And if there was one thing that Uncle Charlie wasn't, I felt, it was frivolous. You could imagine little Lord Fauntleroy getting a skinful, but not Silversmith. And yet he had unquestionably said, Mr. Worcester. I was still pondering like Billio and nowhere near spiking a plausible solution to this mystery when the door opened and what I at first took to be the ghost of Jeeves entered, carrying a breakfast tray. I upset my tea. And then the scent of bacon floated to the nostrils, and feeling that it was improbable that a wraith would be horsing about the place with dishes of eggs and beef, I calmed down a bit and was able to utter,
Jeeves?
Good morning, Charles. I fancied that you would possibly wish to enjoy your breakfast in the privacy of your apartment rather than make one of the party in the dining room.
Oh, thanks, yes, absolutely. A kindly gesture, Jeeves. No doubt it's standing room only for aunts down there.
Yes, sir.
One of them deaf, one of them dotty, one of them Dame Daphne Winkworth, and all of them totally unfit for human consumption on an empty stomach.
Precisely, sir.
Golly. And silversmith, too.
Sir?
Does silversmith minister to the revelers at the morning meal?
Oh, yes, sir.
My God, what a man, Jeeves.
Sir?
Your Uncle Charlie.
Ah, yes, sir. A forceful personality.
Forceful is correct. What's that thing of Shakespeare's about someone having an eye like mother's?
An eye like Mars. To threaten and command is possibly the quotation for which you are groping, sir?
Mm. That's right. Mars. And he takes me right back to the days when I was starting out as a flaneur and man about town, Jeeves, and used to feel very young and bulbous when butlers opened front doors to me.
Indeed,
sir. Oh, yes. Of course, I take such fauna in my stride now, as a rule. But your Uncle Charlie is something special. You really call him Uncle Charlie?
Yes, sir.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. To me, to think of him as Uncle Charlie is like thinking of him as Jimmy or Reggie. Or, for the matter of that, Bertie. Used he, in your younger days, to dandle you on his knee?
Quite frequently, sir.
And you didn't quail? You must have been a child of blood and iron. Honest word. Good. Extraordinarily good bacon, did you?
Home cured, I understand.
I am made, no doubt, from contented pigs. Kippers, too. Not to mention toast, marmalade, and unless my senses deceive me, an apple. Say what you will of Devereux Hall, its hospitality is lavish. I don't know if you've ever noticed it, Jeeves, but a good spirited kipper first thing in the morning seems to put heart into you.
Very true, sir, though I myself am more partial to a slice of ham.
Oh, indeed. Well, there's much to be said on both sides, of course. Oh, by the way, Jeeves, I knew there was something I wanted to ask you.
Sir?
Yes. I can't think how it came to slip my mind. What in the name of everything Bloodsome are you doing here?
I fancy that you might possibly be anxious on that point, sir. I was about to volunteer an explanation. I have come here in attendance on Mr. Thinknottle.
Mr. Thinknottle?
Yes, sir.
But Gussie's not here.
Yes, sir. We arrived at a somewhat late hour last night.
You mean it was Gussie to whom Uncle Charlie was referring when he said that Mr. Wooster had punched the time clock? I'm here saying I'm Gussie, and now Gussie has blown in saying he's me?
Precisely, sir. It is a curious and perhaps somewhat complex situation that has been precipitated.
It's a honey, Jeeves.
Yes, sir.
But how the devil did Gussie get out of stir?
The magistrate decided on second thoughts to substitute a fine for the prison sentence, sir.
What made him do that?
Possibly the reflection that the quality of mercy is not strained, sir.
You mean it droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven?
Precisely, sir, upon the place beneath. His worship would no doubt have taken into consideration the fact that it blesseth him that gives and him that takes and becomes the throned monarch better than his crown.
Yes. Yes, no doubt. What did he soak him? 5 quid?
Yes, sir.
And Gussie brassed up and was free?
Yes, sir.
And then you scooped him in and brought him to Devereux Hall?
Yes, sir.
Why, eh? Why?
It was the only course to pursue, sir. On the one hand, her ladyship, your aunt, was most emphatic in her desire that you should visit the hall. And on the other, Miss Bassett was equally insistent on Mr. Thinknottle doing so. In the event of either of you failing to arrive, inquiries would have been instituted with disastrous results. To take but one aspect of the matter, sir, Miss Bassett is expecting to receive daily letters from Mr. Thinknottle, giving her all the gossip of the hall and describing in detail his life here. These will, of course, have to be written on the hall notepaper and postmarked King Devereux.
True. You speak sooth, Jeeves. I never thought of that.
No, sir.
You know, all this complex stuff could have been perfectly easily avoided if only the beak had had the sense to find Gussie in the first place.
Exceedingly true, sir.
I've said it before, Jeeves, and I'll say it again. All magistrates are asses. Show me a magistrate, and I'll show you a fathead.
There is much in what you say, sir.
So here we are.
Yes.
I'm Gussie, and Gussie is me.
Yes, sir.
And ceaseless vigilance will be required if we are not to gum the game. We shall be walking on eggshells.
A very trenchant figure, sir.
Well, I suppose it had to be. But lay off the Marcus Aurelius stuff, Jeeves, because I don't think I can stand it if you talk about it all being part of the great
will. Very good.
How's Gussie taking it?
Not blithely, sir. I should describe him as disgruntled. He is somewhat exercised in his mind by what he has heard the ladies of the hall saying with regard to your behavior, if I may use the expression, yesterday evening, sir.
The port, you mean?
Yes.
And the hello, hunting we will go?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm afraid I haven't given Gussie a very good send-off. Quite inadvertently, I fear I've established him in the eyes of mine hostesses as one of those whited sepulchres which try to kid the public that they drink nothing but orange juice, and the moment that public's back is turned, start doing the lost weekend stuff with the port.
Yes, sir. And there is also the matter of the dog, sir.
Dog?
Miss Purbright's dog, sir, which you were good enough to bring with you to the hall yesterday evening in order to give the young lady time to accustom her uncle to the idea of receiving the quadruped at the vicarage.
Oh, Sam Goldwyn, yes. Silversmith shoved him in the stables for safekeeping.
Yes, sir, but I regret to say the animal escaped.
Really? When?
Shortly after you had retired to your room yesterday evening, sir. According to my Uncle Charlie, the beast broke loose from its tether and invaded the drawing room via the French windows which had been left open on account of the clemency of the weather. It appears, sir, that the creature then proceeded to leap upon Miss Charlotte Deverill's back and to chase her about the room.
Golly, gee.
Yes.
Poor old self.
Yes.
Of course, one feels bound to point out that this has come more or less as a judgment on her, Jeeves.
Yes, sir?
But for writing all that hello, hunting we will go stuff, Esmond Haddock's going to sing at the concert. Aunt Charlotte should now be in a position to see the thing from the fox's point of view.
May I continue, sir?
Is there more, Jeeves?
A little, sir. My Uncle Charlie informs me that when the ladies rang for him to remove the cur from the room, the mammal bit him.
I say. You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din.
Sir?
Well, just that I wouldn't bite Silversmith myself to please a dying grandmother, Jeeves.
No, sir. Eventually, my Uncle Charlie succeeded in overpowering the vertebrate, sir, and on being informed that it belonged to the vicarage, had it dispatched thither without delay.
I see. So that's another black mark against Gussie's name.
Yes, sir.
Oh, well, let's hope they'll keep it all under their hats and not pass it along to Madeline Bassett. I don't want spanners bunged into Gussie's romance.
No.
No. Talking of romances, I suppose Catsmeat confided in you about his?
Yes, sir.
I thought he would. Amazing the way all these birds come to you and sob out their troubles on your chest.
I find it most gratifying, sir, and I'm always eager to lend such assistance as may lie within my power.
Did he tell you the stop press news?
Sir?
About Esmond Haddock and Corky.
Yes, sir. He informed me of what you had said to him with reference to Mr. Haddock's unswerving devotion to Miss Purbright. He appeared greatly relieved. He feels that the principal obstacle to his happiness has now been removed.
Yes, Catsmeat's sitting pretty. One wishes one could say the same thing of poor old Esmond.
Do you think that Miss Purbright does not reciprocate Mr. Haddock's sentiments?
Oh, she reciprocates them all right, Jeeves, but there's a snag. The trouble is she refuses to consider the idea of hitching up with him unless he defies his aunt. And he very naturally gets the vapors at the mere idea.
Why does the young lady wish Mr. Haddock to defy his aunts, sir?
She says he's allowed them to oppress him from childhood, and it's time he threw off the yoke. She wants him to show her he's a man of intrepid courage. It's the old dragon gag. In the days when knights were bold, as you probably know, girls used to hound fellows into going out and fighting dragons.
So I have been informed.
Unfortunately, dragons are one thing, and aunts are another. And there isn't the remotest chance of Esmond Haddock ever standing up to Dame Daphne Wentworth and the Misses Charlotte, Emmeline, Harriet, and Myrtle Deverell.
I wonder, sir...
What do you mean, you wonder, Jean?
It crossed my mind as a possibility, sir, that were Mr. Haddock's performance at the forthcoming concert to be a success, his attitude towards his relatives might become more resolute. I have not myself had the opportunity of studying the young gentleman's psychology, but from what my Uncle Charlie tells me, I am convinced that he is one of those gentlemen on whom popular acclamation might have sensational effects. Mr. Haddock's has been, as you say, a repressed life, and he has, no doubt, a very marked inferiority complex. The cheers of the multitude frequently act like a powerful drug. upon young gentlemen with inferiority complexes.
You mean if he makes a hit, he will get it up his nose to such an extent that he will be able to look his aunts in the eye and make them wilt?
Precisely, sir.
I believe you've got something there, Jeeves.
At least the theory which I have advanced is a tenable one, sir.
It's more than tenable. It's a pip. Then what we've got to do is strain every nerve to see he makes a hit. What are those things people have? Opera singers and people like that.
You mean a clerk, sir?
That's right. The word was on the tip of my tongue. He must be provided with
A clerk, sir?
With a clerk, yes. It will be your task, Chief, to move about the village, dropping a word here, standing a beer there, till the whole community is impressed with the necessity of cheering Esmond Haddock's song till their eyes bubble. I can leave this to you?
Certainly, sir. I will attend to the matter.
Fine. And I suppose I ought to be getting up and seeing Gussie. There are probably one or two points he will want to discuss. Is there a ruined mill around here?
Not to my knowledge.
Oh. Well, any landmark where you could tell him to meet me. I don't want to have to roam the house and grounds looking for him.
I quite understand, sir. I would suggest that I arrange with Mr. Finknottle to meet you in, say, an hour's time outside the local post office.
Right. Outside the post office in an hour or 60 minutes. And now, Jeeves, if you'll be so good as to turn it on, the refreshing bath.
Very good, sir.
Some three quarters of an hour later, I was hoofing along what King's Deverell was pleased to call its high street, when the door of one of the picturesque cottages which lined that thoroughfare opened, and Catsmeet's sister, Cora Purbright, emerged, carrying an empty tureen. Clearly in pursuance of her policy of being the little mother to her uncle, the sainted Sidney, Corky had been taking a bowl of strengthening soup to one of his needy parishioners. I was delighted to see the young shrimp, not just because she distinctly took the eye, though, as always, she did that, and in heaping measure, but also because I wished to have words with her in her capacity as impresario of the village concert. Much to my regret, I'd come to the conclusion that I would have to withdraw from the pattern Mike knockabout crosstalk act for which I'd been engaged, and heaving alongside her, I was beginning to explain why when I realized she wasn't listening to me. Girls seldom do listen to me, I've noticed. Her face, I might add, was drawn, and a frown marred the alabaster purity of her brow.
I wouldn't have believed, Bertie, that anybody except Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper could be such an authority on the film world as Mrs. Clara Wellbeloved. I'm sure the only reason she drinks my soup is so she can talk about Hollywood.
Corky.
Would you believe she knows more about it than I do? And I've been moving in celluloid circles 2 years come Lammas Eve.
Corky.
Do you know, she knows exactly how many times everybody's been divorced and why, how much every picture for the last 20 years has grossed, and how many Warner Brothers there are.
Corky.
A very remarkable old lady, Bertie, but a bit exhausting after an hour or so. I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
Yes, I did.
Well, why don't you?
Because, young C. Purbright, you won't let me get a bally word in edgeways.
Oh, have I been talking? I'm so sorry. What's on your mind, my king?
Well, for a start, this village concert...
Yes. No doubt you want to know who's playing opposite you in the Pattern Mike Crosstalk Act.
No, I...
An artiste by the name of Dobbs, Bertie. Police Constable Dobbs, the local rosser, to be precise. And in this connection, there is one thing I want to impress upon you with all the emphasis at my disposal. When socking Constable Dobbs with your umbrella at the points where the script calls for it, don't pull your punches. Let the uncouth blue bottle have it with every ounce of wrist and muscle. I want to see him come off that stage a mass of contusion.
Corky,
He's the village atheist, you see, Bertie, and a thorn in my poor old Uncle Sidney's flesh. He pops out at him from side streets and makes offensive cracks about Jonah and the whale.
Yes, Catsmeet said...
So this crosstalk act has been sent from heaven, you see. I mean, in ordinary life, you get so few opportunities for socking cops with umbrellas. And if ever a cop needed the treatment, it is Ernest Dobbs. When he isn't smirching Jonah and the whale with his low sneers, he's asking Uncle Sidney where Cain got his wife. You can't say that sort of thing is pleasant for a sensitive vicar. So shoo to the line, my poppet. Let the chips fall where they may.
Corky!
Yes?
I can't do it.
What do you mean?
I've been trying to tell you for the past 5 minutes. I'm handing in my portfolio as Pat.
You're walking out on the act?
Yes, now listen, dash it, while I explain.
How do you think a romantic girl like Madeline Bassett would react if she learnt that her lover, the pure and spiritual Augustus Finknottle, had been going about in a green beard socking policemen with umbrellas?
I've no idea.
Well, I have. She would be revolted to the depths of her soul, and the engagement would blow a fuse on the spot. And so, since at the moment I am Gussie, I've had no option but to resign.
Mm. Oh, I see what you mean.
Good. I'm glad you understand. However, Corky, do not despair. I have the very substitute for you, viz., Gussie himself.
I thought he was doing 14 days without the option.
No, he's been released and is now in residence at the Hall under the name of Bertram Wooster.
Golly, really?
Yes.
Oh, well, that's fine then. Are you likely to be seeing Mr. Finknottle in the near future?
I'm on my way to meet him now.
Oh, well, come over to the car then. I'll give you a script for him. And then I really must buzz off back to the vicarage. I want to take Sam Goldwyn for his constitutional. Here you are, Bertie.
Oh, thanks. One other thing, Corky, before you go.
What?
Esmond Haddock.
Yes? Is he still swarming round Gertrude Winkworth?
Corky, you're a chump. You've got a completely wrong angle on this Haddock. Far from being enamoured of Gertrude Winkworth, I don't suppose he'd care, except in a distant cousinly way, if she choked on a fishbone. You are the lodestar of his life.
What?
I had it direct from his personal lips last night. He was a bit pickled at the time, which makes it all the more impressive, because in vino, what's the word?
He said I was the lodestar of his life.
With a still in front of the lodestar,
oh,
yes.
Bertie, if you're kidding us.
Of course I'm not. He also informed me that the only reason he'd been making Gertrude Winkworth the plaything of an idle hour is to make you jealous.
Really? Oh, that's just the sort of thing he would think of. Bless him. What a woolly lambkin that man is.
Woolly lambkin? A fellow with a 46-inch chest?
Yes. Oh, if only he'd stop curling up like carbon paper in front of those aunts of his.
Ah, yes, now. That's what I wanted to talk to you about, Corky. The above Haddock is singing a hunting song at the concert, words by his Aunt Charlotte, music by his Aunt Myrtle. You don't dispute that.
No, but...
Now, listen, listen, will you? And stop behaving like a Wednesday matinee audience. Suppose Esmond's hunting song is a smackerino.
Suppose it is.
Well, the cheers of the multitude frequently act like a powerful drug on birds like E. Haddock, who have inferiority complexes. Rouse such birds by, for instance, whistling through your fingers and yelling, beast, beast, when they sing hunting songs, and they become changed men. Their morale stiffens. Their tails shoot up like rockets. They find themselves regarding the tough eggs, before whom they have always been accustomed to crawl, as less than the dust beneath their chariot wheels. If Esmond Haddock goes with anything like a bang, I guarantee it won't be long before those aunts of his will be climbing trees and pulling them up after them whenever he looks squiggle-eyed at them.
Mm. I believe you're right, Bertie.
Jeeves' theory, not mine.
I believe Jeeves is right, then.
Well, of course Jeeves is right. Jeeves is always right. And it's happened before, of course.
Huh?
Do you know Bingo Little?
Well, just to say hello to. He married some sort of female novelist, didn't he?
Rosie M. Banks, yes, and their union was blessed. In due course, a bouncing baby was added to the strength. Now, keep your eye on that baby, for the plot centers around it.
I'm all ears.
Well, since you last saw Bingo, Mrs. Bingo, by using her substantial pull, secured for him the post of editor of Wee Tots, a journal for the nursery and the home. A very good job in most respects, but with this flaw, that the salary attached to it was not all it might have been. See?
Yes, I follow you.
Well done. Well, week after week, therefore, he would creep into the presence of the proprietor, P.P. Perkis, and try to stick him for a raise, only to have the blighter gaze at him with fishy eyes and talk about the tightness of money and the growing cost of pulp paper. And Bingo would say, oh, quite right, Mr. Perkis. And I see, Mr. Perkis, yes, I see. And creep out again. That's Act One.
But mark the sequel.
You're right, mark the sequel. Came a day when Bingo's bouncing baby entered in a baby contest against some of the warmest competition in South Kensington, scooped in the first prize.
Good for him.
And the next morning, Bingo, with a strange light on his face, strode into P.P. Perkis's private office without knocking, banged on the desk with his fist, and said he wished to see another 10 fish in his pay envelope from now on.
What happened then?
P.P. Perkis sagged like a wet sock and said, why, yes, yes, of course, most certainly, Mr. Little, adding that he had been on the point of suggesting some such idea himself. Well, I mean, that shows you what.
Golly, yes, Bertie, it certainly does.
Quite. So all we need for Esmond is what is known as a clack to provide thunderous applause and adequate cheering to the rafters, and it's in the bag.
I've authorized Jeeves to scatter beers around the village to ensure this, but you can help in that direction too.
Well, of course I can. My standing here is terrific. I have the place in my pocket. Look, I must get after this right away, Bertie. I can't wait. Do you mind if I leave you now?
No, thing. You are dismissed, for I too must depart and seek out Augustus Fignottle. Toodle pip, Corky.
Cheerio.
And so saying, she leapt into her two-seater, clapped spurs to it, and vanished over the horizon at a high rate of MPH, leaving me, as I continued my walk to the post office, with something approaching a light heart. A Worcester is always backed up, even if only temporarily, by the thought that he has been instrumental in re-sunshining a pal's life. When I got to the tryst, about 5 minutes behind schedule time, I found Gussie already on the strength. Jeeves, in speaking of this Fignottle, had, if you remember, described him as disgruntled. And it was plain at a glance that the passage of time had done nothing to gruntle him. The eyes behind their horn-rimmed spectacles were burning with fury and resentment and all that sort of thing. He looked like a peevish halibut. In moments of emotion, Gussie's resemblance to a marine monster always becomes accentuated. It seemed to me that a cheery, pep-giving word would be in order.
What-ho, 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 what-ho!
Aha! This is a pretty state of things, Worcester.
Yes, indeed, pretty without a shadow of D. But tails up, Gussie, old egg. Storm clouds may lower and whatnot, but you're better off here than you would be in a dungeon with a platoon of resident rats, eh?
No, I entirely disagree with you. I would greatly have preferred prison. When you're in prison, you don't have people calling you Worcester. How do you suppose I feel, knowing that everybody thinks I'm you?
What? But dash it, how do you suppose I feel, knowing that everybody here thinks you're me?
I don't know if you're aware, Worcester, what your reputation is in these parts. In case you are under any illusions, let me inform you that your name is Muck. Those women at breakfast were drawing their skirts away as I passed. They shivered when I spoke to them. From time to time, I would catch them looking at me in a way that would have wounded a smash-and-grab man. And as if that wasn't enough, you seem in a single evening to have made my name mud, too. What's all this I hear about you getting tight last night and singing hunting songs?
I didn't get tight, Gussie. Just pleasantly mellowed. And I sang hunting songs because my host seemed to wish it. One has to humor one's host. So they mentioned that, did they?
They mentioned it, all right. It was the chief topic of conversation at the breakfast table. And what's going to happen if they report it to Madeline, may I ask?
I'd buy a stout denial.
It wouldn't work.
But it might. After all, what can they prove?
Madeline's godmother said she came into the dining room and found you on a chair waving a decanter.
True, we concede that. But who is to say that the decanter was not emptied exclusively by Esmond Haddock?
Perhaps you're right. All the same, I wish you'd be more careful. The whole thing has been most annoying and upsetting.
Still, it's part of the great web. What?
Great web?
One of Marcus Aurelius's cracks. He said, does aught befall you, it is good. It is part of the destiny of the universe ordained for you from the beginning. All that befalls you is part of the great web.
Damn Marcus Aurelius, Bertie.
Oh, righto.
Blast Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, yes, yes.
Damn blast, damn blast, damn blast him.
Oh, absolutely.
Damn and blast him, Bertie, 1,000 times. Damn, 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 damn.
Quite, Gussie. Now, about the concert, Gussie.
Yes?
Well, the fact of the matter is, because you're now me and I'm you, we want you to take part in the crosstalk act.
What crosstalk act?
Cat's Meats, the one he wrote.
Herb Wright, that hellhound, that fiend in human shape, that preeminent toad, I'll do nothing of the kind. It was Pertwright who forced me to wade in a Trafalgar Square fountain, Worcester. The only thing I'll do for Pertwright with pleasure is disembowel him with a blunt bread knife.
Now, wait a minute, Gussie. No one's asking you to do it for Cat's Meat. It's Cat's Meat's sister, Miss Pertwright, you know, who's impresarioing this concert. I was to have played Pat in the Crosstalk Act, but owing to the changed circs, we now want you to sustain the role.
Do you? Well, we'll see about that. What the devil is this damn thing?
Have you seen it? Pongo Twistleton and Barmy Pitts do it every year at the Drone Smoker.
I never go to the Drone Smoker.
Oh. Oh. Well, it's, how shall I put it? It's something in the nature of a crosstalker. The principals are a couple of Irishmen named Pat and Mike. That's you and Police Constable Dobbs. And they come on. But I have a script here. If you glance through it, you'll get the idea.
Uh. And you say Pirbright wrote this?
Yes.
I might have guessed it. The thing is absolutely drivel. It has no dramatic coherence. It lacks motivation and significant form. Who are these two men supposed to be?
Well, I told you. A couple of Irishmen named Pat and Mike.
Well, perhaps you can explain what their social position is, for it's frankly beyond me. But Pat, for instance, appears to move in the very highest circles, for he describes himself as dining at Buckingham Palace, and yet his wife takes in lodgers.
Oh, I see what you mean. Odd.
Inexplicable. Is it credible that a man of his class would be invited to dinner at Buckingham Palace, especially as he is apparently completely without social savoir-faire? At this dinner party to which he alludes, he relates how the Queen asked him if he would like some mulligatawny, and he, thinking there was nothing else coming, had six helpings, with the result that, to quote his own words, he spent the rest of the evening sitting in a corner full of soup. And in describing the incident, he prefaces his remarks at several points with the expressions begorra and faith and begob. Irishmen don't talk like that. Irishmen are poets. They say things like, an evening like this, it makes me wish I was back in County Clare, watching the cows and the tall grass.
Do they?
Here's another bit of incoherent raving. My sister's in the ballet. You say your sister's in the ballet? Yes, begorra, begorra. My sister's in the ballet. What does your sister do in the ballet? She comes rushing in, and then she goes rushing out. What does she have to rush like that for? Faith and begob, because it's a rushing ballet. Well, it simply doesn't make sense. And now we come to something else that is quite beyond me. The word bus, after the line, because it's a rushing ballet, and in other places throughout the script, the word bus in brackets occurs. It conveys nothing to me. Can you explain it?
Oh, rather, yes. It's short for business. That's where you hit Mike with your umbrella. To show the audience there's been a joke, you see.
Are these things jokes?
Yes.
I see. I see. Well, of course, that throws a different light on it. Wait a moment. Did you say that I am supposed to strike my colleague with an umbrella?
That's right.
And did I hear you say that he was a policeman?
That's it. Dobbs, the local rozzer.
The whole thing is impossible and utterly out of the question. Have you any idea what happens when you hit a policeman with an umbrella? I did so on emerging from the fountain in Trafalgar Square, and I certainly do not intend to do it again.
But can I say...
Let me put you quite straight, Worcester, as to what my stand is in this matter. I shall not say begorra. I shall not say faith and begob. I shall not assault policemen with an umbrella. In short, I absolutely and positively refuse to have the slightest association with this degraded buffoonery. Wait till I meet Miss Pirbright. I'll tell her a thing or two. I'll show her she can't play fast and loose with human dignity like this.
Here she comes now.
Eh?
Oh. Quite. Hello, Corky.
Hello, Bertie.
Down, Sam. Down, down. Gussie, I don't think you...
Oh, is this Mr. Finknottle? How do you do, Mr. Finknottle? I'm so glad to see you, Mr. Finknottle. How lucky meeting you. I wanted to talk to you about the act.
Yes? We've just been having a word or two on that subject, Corky. Gussie is kicking a bit about playing Pat.
Oh, no.
Yes. I thought you might like to reason with him. I'll, leave you to it.
What? Here.
And pausing only to disentangle myself from the cheese hound, who was doing his best to strop his tongue on my face, I left her to it and burst off. Looking around as I turned the corner, I saw that she had attached herself with one slim hand to the lapel of Gussie's coat, and with the other was making wide, appealing gestures, indicating to the most vapid and irreflective observer that she was giving him treatment A. Well pleased, therefore, I made my way back to the hall, keeping an eye skinned for prowling aunts, and won through without disaster to my room. I was enjoying a thoughtful smoke there about half an hour later when Gussie came in, and I could see right away that this was not the morose, sullen Finknottle I had just left. Admittedly, he was still an undersized gargoyle who looked like Lester de Pester in that comic strip in one of the New York papers, but his bearing was buoyant. His face glowed. He radiated smugness.
In fine, 20 minutes in Corky society had turned him from a blameless newt fancier into as pronounced a ham as ever drank small ports in bodegas and called people laddie. For half a jiffy, indeed, I thought he was going to address me as laddie.
I say, Bertie, why didn't you tell me that Miss Pirbright was Cora Starr, the film actress? I've long been one of her warmest admirers. What a delightful girl, is she not? And how unlike her brother, whom I consider and always shall consider England's leading louse. She's made me see this crosstalk acting in an entirely new light.
I thought he might.
It's extraordinary that a girl as pretty as that should also have a razor-keen intelligence. And that amazing way of putting her arguments with a crystal clarity, which convinces you in an instant that she's right in every respect.
Yes, Corky's a persuasive young gumboil.
I would prefer you not to speak of her as a gumboil, Worcester. Corky, eh? That's what you call her, is it? A charming name.
What was the outcome of the conference? Are you going to do the act?
Oh, yes, it's all settled. She overcame my objections entirely. We ran through the script after you left us, and she quite brought me round to her view that there is nothing in the least degrading in this simple, wholesome form of humour. Hokum, yes, but as she pointed out, good theatre. She is convinced that I shall go over big.
Oh, you'll knock 'em cold. I'm sorry I can't play Pat myself.
A good thing, probably. I doubt if you're the type.
Of course I'm the type. I should have given a sensational performance.
Corky thinks not. She was telling me how thankful she was that you had stepped out and I had taken over. She said the part wants broad, robust treatment, and you would have played it too far down. It's a part that calls for personality and the most precise timing. And she said that the moment she saw me, she felt that here was the ideal Pat. Girls with her experience can tell in a second.
Oh, quite. And may I ask, how about Dobbs?
Eh?
When last heard from, you were a bit agitated at the prospect of having to slosh Police Constable Dobbs with your umbrella.
Oh, Dobbs. He's out. He's been given his notice. He came along when we were rehearsing and started to read Mike's lines, but he was hopeless. No technique, no personality. And he wouldn't take direction, kept arguing every point with the management. Until finally, Corky got heated and began raising her voice, and he got heated and began raising his voice, and the upshot was that that dog of hers, excited no doubt by the uproar, bit him in the leg.
Good Lord.
Yes. It created an unpleasant atmosphere. Corky put the animal's case extremely well, but Dobbs refused to accept her view that the offence was one calling for a mere reprimand. He took the creature into custody and is keeping it at the police station until he has been able to ascertain whether this was his first bite. Apparently, a dog that's had only one bite is in a strong position legally.
Sam Gerwin bit Silversmith last night.
Did he? Well, if that comes out, I'm afraid counsel for the prosecution will have a talking point. But to go on with my story. Corky, incensed, and quite rightly, by Dobbs's intransigent attitude, threw him out of the act, and he's getting her brother to play the part. I am looking forward to having Pirbright as a partner. I can think of few men whom it would give me more genuine pleasure to hit with an umbrella. Yes, but I can't stay here talking. Corky has asked me to lunch at the vicarage. I must be getting along. I just looked in to give you these poems.
These what?
These Christopher Robin poems here.
What's this for?
He'll recite them at the concert. The ones marked with a cross. I was to have done them, Madeline, making a great point of it. You know how fond she is of the Christopher Robin poems. But now, of course, we have switched acts. But I don't mind telling you, I feel extremely relieved. There's one about the little blighter going hoppity, hoppity, hop, which, as I say, I feel extremely relieved.
But dash it!
Oh, it's no good saying, but dash it. To think I didn't say, but dash it, when she forced those nauseous productions on me. You've got to do them, she insists. The first thing she'll want to know is how they went.
But the tough eggs at the back of the back row will rush the stage and lynch me.
Well, I shouldn't wonder. Still, you've got the consolation.
What's that?
The thought that all that befalls you is part of the great web. Cheerio, Bertie.
Hoppity, hoppity, hop. Oh, Lord.
Episode, the parts were played as follows. Jeeves, Michael Horton, Bertie, Richard Bryars, Corky Pirbright, Joe Kendall, Catsmeat Pirbright, Kenneth Fortescue, Gussie Pinknottle, David Valor. The episode was adapted for radio by Chris Miller from the book The Mating Season by P.G. Woodhouse. The program was produced by Peter Titheridge.